Hi, I'm Ty.
And I'm Laura.
And we're Cancer Moms.
We will be discussing the ins and outs of what to expect on the wild ride we call childhood cancer.
Join us twice a month as we share stories of hope, inspiration, hear testimonies from families and healthcare professionals, and discuss the amazing people and organizations who help cancer families every day.
We are the ladies of Golden Voices.
On today's episode of Golden Voices, Tyler and Laura explore the amazing world of picks, ports, and surgeries, and whatever else comes up. Hey, Ty.
Hey, Laura. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing good today.
Great. Episode 3.
I'm so excited that we're here together again today, and just we get to talk about all things childhood cancer.
I know, and we have an extra guest in the office today, Princess Leia, my therapy dog who comes to the office. She's a beautiful 3-year-old black lab, and she's staring at me because I said her name. She's got her little dog bed in here, and she's comfy and currently not begging for treats.
She already got a treat, though.
She did. She got a couple. She got a puppuccino on the way here, too. So,
oh, goodness. I know, she should probably be like the poster dog.
She should be for everything. We should add her little caricature of her.
Oh, she should definitely be in there.
Oh, my gosh. Yep, she's looking at us like, what are you guys doing? But anyhow, she's often here, but this is her first recording session.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
So how we kind of got to ports, picks, and everything else that kind of comes along with how our children receive treatment and get the
necessary meds, like chemo and blood and platelets and all that good stuff.
All the good things. Laura and I both, because of our children having different diagnoses, Lucy has had ports and PICCs and IVs, where Mac only had ports and IVs, right? He never had a PICC line.
Mm-mm.
So do you want to kind of share today a little bit about how Mac ended up getting his central line and how he kind of got started with that?
Yeah, absolutely. So they're called central lines because there's various types, and we're going to talk a little bit about the different types of central lines, but ideally they go, you know, subcutaneously in through the internal jugular and then into the heart and deliver meds directly, and so it gets pumped throughout the body. And it's the most minimally invasive way to deliver certainly chemo and to get blood and platelets and whatever else you might need. We talked about kind of on our last podcast our different unique journeys to getting to diagnosis. And for part of Mac, once we finally, after seemingly months of getting to diagnosis, our admission for our first chemo happened. And that same day, we had a port placement. So we started out that morning getting surgery because later they would need to access the port to start his first round of chemo. So we had that planned. And we knew that that's how we were starting out our early morning. And, you know, I think he didn't know what to expect. So he wasn't that nervous, but they, you know, and we'll post some pictures on our website too, because sometimes it's easier to, I know I'm visual, so it's easier for me to see exactly what we're talking about. And we can even show your own kids' ports. Because they're very interesting. Like, I've seen pictures, and obviously I used to work in pediatric oncology, so I would show different patients what ports look like. But again, it's always different when you have your own kid. So Mac is really, really thin. Like, super skinny, not much body fat at all. And so his port placed it in the upper left-hand side of his chest. And there's about a maybe 2-inch incision where they go and place the port kind of under the skin, suture it in place, and then they insert the line that goes up into the internal jugular. And so you can actually see because he was so thin, you could see kind of in the side of his neck, you could see the line, like just barely under his skin, like this little kind of extra little, I don't know, like string underneath almost. But his port stuck out pretty prominently because he was so thin, so you could always see it. And his was tender at all times. And I don't know if that, you know, I'm sure legitimately there wasn't a lot of fat covering it. You know, he was very aware of his port, and even long after his port was removed, still was pretty tender about that area. But so anyhow, so we went in. They, for his type of treatment, there was kind of a no-brainer for his age, being 12 at the time. A metaport was the best choice for us. It, again, he could swim, he could do whatever he wanted to. It's all sewn up under the skin. There's no external access. So that was the best choice. And it was sore for a couple days, but then it just became a part of, I mean, he had a hard time like lifting his arm for a couple days, but it was also right before chemo. So I'm sure that didn't help with kind of those symptoms and also that, you know, worry about something new happening. But they're great. And I mean, especially, you know, we're talking about pediatric hospitals. And even when we would go to our local hospital for lab draws, they were amazing. You know, one of the important things that most hospitals offer is a lidocaine numbing cream we called Emla. And Mac would like his Emla to sit on there for a really long time. They really say like half an hour to an hour. A Mac would like it on there for like a full hour at least. And it really does help with the needle poking pain because they have to kind of, the hardest part is they have to feel around to feel the port. And then there's kind of this little button in the middle. And again, we'll post pictures, but this button part is really relatively small. And so they have to get the butterfly needle, and we'll post pictures kind of what that is too. So it's a really thin needle going into that area. And so they have to kind of feel around, get it right in the middle of that port. And then presumably you're good to go. But that numbing cream definitely helps. And most kids would describe it as that pressure then. So that pressure, that uncomfortable pressure of a nurse having to find that line port. But once it was in, right, they tape it up, they put some tagoderm around it, and then you're good to go for however many days. You know, usually they like to change them, you know, 7 to 14 days. They don't want it really accessed for longer than that. But presumably it stays in for all of treatment. So Max would stay in for days. Lucy's would stay in usually, I'm sometimes just for a couple hours.
Yeah, it was just kind of depending on where we were in the stage of our cancer treatment with Lucy, because in that first, you know, several months, we actually didn't even have a port. So we were kind of juggling PICC lines and different IVs throughout that time, just because, you know, she got diagnosed. And of course, they put in the PICC line fairly early on in the start of the journey. But then after she got diagnosed with MRSA, we unfortunately had to remove that PICC line because they believed that it was contaminated. And so then we had to go to peripheral draws. We couldn't even have an IV at that point either. So it was just like daily pokes of trying to get her body to produce enough blood. And it was so hard because her veins were so tiny. And I always just, seriously, I prayed every single time one of the phlebotomists came in, because they were like, oh, it is so small. I hope we get this. I'm praying for you to just hit it, because if you don't hit it, like, you're gonna get maybe one more chance. But if you don't get it in two tries, I'm sorry, you're not going to do this. And unfortunately, that happened once. And, you know, you feel horrible. But at the same time, I just was watching this three-year-old little girl sitting there screaming, you know, because we were just having to hold her down and just be able to make her lie still to be able to get that draw, you know. So what Laura says about the port, once we were able to get that port, it is seriously a saving grace.
It's life-saving. And I think that, you know, when we talk about kind of a peripheral IV, that's what we think of when we go and we, you know, maybe give blood, or we have to, you know, take you know, hospital for some procedure, or you're getting saline. You know, it's not designed to stay in for longer than a couple days. And it's not ideal for chemo treatment because you need medication so often and frequently. And, you know, a lot of times, I mean, I'm sure most of you have gone in for draws and sometimes they don't get it on the first time. I mean, those little veins can collapse, and it's just not a long-term solution for kids and adults for administering chemo meds.
Yeah, and so that, you know, once we were able, I think I was looking at some notes and just looking back, I think we didn't even get our actual port until January 22nd. So she was diagnosed on November 3rd, and we were in and out of different types of IVs and PICC lines through that time just because of all the things. But, you know, once we were able to get that, it just gave us a new outlook, I think, on when we did arrive for treatments and different blood draws, whether we had to get blood draws before we went up to the hospital or during our visits that we were already there. So I just know, as Laura had mentioned, that Lucy always referred to the magic cream, and she actually preferred to have it on there for a longer time too, where it was almost like this reddish color.
Max would get like even lighter. His already pale skin would get like even a shade like lighter than that. That's really funny.
So it's just funny how each kiddo has their own little characteristics that makes their days of treatment a little bit easier.
In case you don't know, PICC lines are external. And so they're usually, she had hers in her arm.
Yeah, in her right arm.
In her right arm. And so it's great because blood draws, you don't have to poke them. I mean, it's like, sweet, you already got your lines out of your body. And so it's really minimally invasive, which is really a great thing, especially for younger kids when you have a hard time kind of reasoning with them. I don't want to, so much trauma getting poked over and over again at any age for a lot of people, but it's really a great option because you don't have to poke the skin because the lines are external. However, you can't get it wet, you can't bathe, you can't swim.
You have to be careful, like even just like running around and like bumping it or something catches on it or something, it could potentially rip it out.
Like usually, you know, can put like some netting or something over it, but you're talking about active kids and it's a, I don't know. I mean, Mac never had one. I've known a lot of people with them, and there's definitely pros and cons to all of these. But it's great because you don't have to get poked all the time. You're just poking the tubes that are already hanging out of your body. But yeah, you have to be so careful with it.
And I think the dressing changes were difficult, just with all of the different types of tapes, you know, to make sure that things stayed secure so bacteria and infection, you know, didn't start. And so those were, I think, challenging for us because Lucy's body never did very well with the tape. I think that sometimes there was certain ingredients or how they made that tape that actually affected her skin. So maybe a little bit of an irritant. And so it almost was like her skin was like so thin, really, really sensitive. So I think that really made it difficult with those lines because those dressings did have to be changed and to make sure that things were clean and that keeps them safe, obviously, through their treatment. But I just know that I was really grateful. It was really kind of tough because she got a PICC line. She got MRSA, removed the PICC line, and then they weren't going to put in the PICC line until I think it was like 7 or 10 days. There was like an extended period of time that, you know, she was free of fever and any type of test that came back that said the MRSA was still there. Then they had to wait. Obviously, they couldn't put it back in just because the risk of contamination again. So we finally got through that period, and we actually ended up going home. When we went home on December 23rd, we actually had to continue giving the MRSA antibiotics through the PICC line. So it was a lot of work, just, you know, multiple times a day. I was essentially just a nurse at home giving my child, you know, her medications that she needed. And so we finished that on January 18th was our last dose. So
she had the PICC line until then.
Yeah, she had the PICC line until then. And then we went in on her scheduled appointment, which was January 22nd. And so they removed the PICC line. And then obviously she had her port inserted. And then we kind of had, I think for the most part, her port did really, really well. And she had a good experience with it. Unfortunately, we had a situation happen at our local hospital where she had gotten a fever, and instead of going up to Dornbecker's, which for us is over an hour, we had communicated with our doctors and they said, hey, you could go ahead and try your local hospital, because they knew at that time she probably wasn't neutropenic depending on where she was in her treatment. But we had to go to our local hospital and they unfortunately didn't access the port correctly. That was probably, I think, about a year after she had originally got her port. And when they went to access the port, they went to access it with no saline. So it was just like all she did was take the needle, attached it to the dry syringe. So she didn't prime it or anything to kind of get it ready. And I kind of knew in my heart that something didn't really like set well, that this picture that was going on, like I was like, I'm pretty sure this isn't right, you know, but I'm just trusting because we're at the hospital.
Right,
because
that's what we do. And
we do. We just like, okay, these people are kind of in charge at this moment. You know, they have reassured us that they've had many, many years of being on the, you know, IV teams and just having done many different port accesses. And so, of course, we just trust them. But just kind of looking at this overall situation, I just knew that something wasn't right. But I was still relatively new in this journey that I didn't feel comfortable enough, like right away, to be like, hey, that's not the correct way to access a port. But as soon as she said, oh, it's not working, I knew. And I said something to my husband, Kellen. I said, there's something that's not right, and we need to say something. So she left the room and ended up coming back. Well, in that meantime, we ended up calling one of our nurses that we know and just kind of asking, like, hey, can you just run through how to access the port just one more time for us? Just so, like, I could have a clear picture to make sure. And let alone, she was wrong, unfortunately. She just forgot to prime. So what she did is she accessed the port and took the dry syringe and started pumping the air.
Oh my gosh, that makes my stomach.
Yeah, she started pumping that air into that port, and I about lost it on her. I was like,
I think you did, actually. I think you're really playing it down, because I know the rest of this story. So here's Ty. She's so cute and sweet, and Ty's got another side to her when it comes to her child's medical care. She's beet red right now, let me just tell you, if you could see her face. This is her PG-rated version.
I'm not going to lie, everyone. I absolutely lost it on this lady. And it finally got to the point where my husband, Kellen, is usually the pretty neutral one in situations that, you know, are a little bit more difficult. But he steps up just to kind of, like, smooth the situation, because I apparently get this, like, tone in my voice. And I have this, like, look on my face that he refers to as just the not-so-nice tie.
Does it rhyme with wit?
Yes, it does. And he just absolutely knew I was right. And so he definitely had, you know, our back and Lucy's back during this, because we just knew that if you damaged that port, yeah, it doesn't really affect you. We do everything. That's our lifeline. Like, it's such a critical part of this journey and making sure that we keep that little port safe. And so what ended up turning out is she did access that port incorrectly, and we had asked them to call in another person to do that for us. So unfortunately, not too long after, we started having several different complications with the port. It was starting to clot. It just wasn't drawing the way that it was supposed to. We had to use a medication called TPA.
I can tell you what that means.
Oh, yes, please. Yes, do,
okay. Laura. And I think part of it also is that when you do this a lot, you talk about flushing the port. And so really there's, you know, after each medication or whatnot, you have to put some saline in it. And then that last kind of push is heparin, because that keeps it from clotting. But TPA, as we call it, okay, let's see if I get this right. And disclaimer, this is an asterisk. We are not medical professionals. We do not have MDs behind our names. So go ahead and look all this stuff up. Don't take it for gospel truth of what we're saying. But from our research and from our own personal experiences. So TPA is tissue plasminogen activator. I know, no wonder they call it TPA. Not to be confused with TPN, which is essentially like when you're not able to take in food by mouth or PO, that you have to get your nutrients via your port. Big surprise. Everything goes in the port, and that's called TPN. I don't know what it stands for, but this is a TPA. So it's a medication that's given that tries to declot, that tries to
break up that tissue, right?
Plasminogen activator, right? And so, yeah, so take it from here now that I'll never remember what that means again other than TPA, but
I actually kind of liked that knowing I actually couldn't actually say that word. So it's probably why I've always just said TPA, because I try to say that word three times fast. I'm sure not very many people could do it. So we had to go into our office during one of Lucy's routine visits, and we have just had several rounds of this medication to try to break up these clots. And I think at one point, I think the first time we had to do it, we had to insert the TPA and then wait a half an hour. And then they would try to come back, flush it again. If there wasn't any movement, then they would put it back in, and then you would wait for like an hour. Like,
oh my gosh, it's the longest. We had to do it a number of times, and it takes so long.
It is. It's so long. So then it's like 30 minutes, and then an hour. And then I think there's a four-hour segment, I think, was the next round, because there's I think, three or four routine protocols they have to do before they actually replace the port. And I think, like, for most children, I would
would say replacement of the port. Does that happen a lot?
No, it really doesn't. And infections, I think, are pretty minimal. But ports do kind of wear out. So you're looking at, you know, a leukemia treatment kind of average 3 years, right? Depending on, it's different if you're a boy or girl. And so really the longer those ports stay in, you know, the more wear and tear on them. And so sometimes when you do have those long treatments, they need to be replaced. So, right, hers probably wouldn't have, but...
I don't know. I just really feel like that one experience of the faulty access was a very likely contributor of, like, why her port didn't work. So... we ended up having it replaced.
Yeah, Mac, towards back half of his treatment, we had to get it a couple times because, right, it just wasn't drawing. And, right, there's a number of different reasons why. But the last thing they want to do is replace the port. And so, especially because, right, surgeries when your counts are low. I mean, there's so much risk of infection when you're putting a foreign body into your body. So it's not ideal. So they try to do all these steps first.
I was looking back on my notes, Laura, and it was about a year or two. So this says May 8th, we had TPA and we kind of went through that long protocol. So it was just right after that we ended up having a second port replaced. The nice thing for Lucy is that they were able to go back into the same exact spot as they previously did. I know that that was one of the things that they had a long discussion with us is if they couldn't, then they would have to put it on the other side. And I was just really praying that they would be able to. And now looking at it, instead of having two scars, mm-hmm. she only has the one on the right side. So, and for also for Lucy, you know, after that port was removed for the final time, which was this final like piece to the whole puzzle, you know, that we finally have made it and she did it. And it was just really amazing. But unfortunately for her, her scar hasn't healed as well. And I wonder if it's because it was opened up and then healed and then opened up again and then healed and then opened up again and then healed. And I just feel like that scar is pretty large for her tiny little body. So it'll be interesting, you know, as she gets older and grows, like what it actually kind of looks like.
It will whiten and it will be probably nothing, right, when she's a full body. Max is the same way. And his is, you know, still a little raised. Even when they went in and they took it out, right, they tried to really tighten up that scarring, but he's, yeah, kind of the same way. There's a whole bunch of different ports. We've talked about PICs. We've talked about, I mean, I don't know. Again, this may be interesting to some. I think it's interesting just because we find this stuff interesting. So there's like double lumen ports. There's the Broviac. Sometimes there's a double metaport, or the metaport is the formal name of it, the brand name. And so it's different for different kind of treatments. So like a double lumen Broviac are useful for kids who are undergoing kind of that peripheral for bone marrow transplants, either right harvesting their own or getting somebody else's, because there's a lot of things that have to go on with that, obviously. So there's different, and those are external as well. And so depending on diagnosis, it's so interesting because depending on diagnosis, it kind of dictates what kind of port you're going to have, which I just find really interesting. So I think the most common ones are a regular like metaport, PIC lines, Broviacs. Oh my, right. And probably a lot of other ones. You guys can write in and tell us what kind you or your kids have and pros and cons.
Yeah, that'd be actually quite interesting.
I know, right? Send us a picture. So maybe if you remember, Mac, his tumor is in his right tibia. And so we did, I think, 8 rounds of chemo. Then we took a break, a few week break, before surgery, because they want to make sure the counts were recovered, that he was feeling good, strong, like going into surgery in the best possible situation. That was a really nice break. It was like, oh, good, he started to feel better. Like, it's like, oh, this is great. He was still walking. And then I was like, okay, here we go. And at the time, he was really, I just remember he was like, just get this cancer out of me. He was, and he didn't have any idea what to expect. I mean, I've had a lot of surgeries, so I kind of know what to expect, but you know what to expect when you're getting your tibia taken out. So we had our amazing orthopedic oncologist, you know, we discussed kind of what we thought the best option for Mac would be. And some options were to do an allograft, which is essentially like a cadaver. There's some talk about some people will take your fibula and then put your fibula, because the fibula is a non-weight-bearing bone, and put it in place of the tibia. But The tibia is so much thicker than the fibula. And so that was like my least favorite option. I guess some people are doing 3D printed, but really we decided for Mac, having another bone in there that would eventually kind of engraft with his own bone was the best option. So really, it was really interesting because right as soon as Mac was diagnosed, our team was already looking for a good donor fit, a good cadaver fit. So super grateful for, you know, all donors, organ donors, you know, certainly it's something that I think about way more than he does. I think he just doesn't want to think about it. But that, unfortunately, you know, somebody lost their life and horribly sad to think about, but so grateful that somebody, you know, donated their body and that we got a tibia that was a good fit. So there were actually two chosen. This one was the best fit that needed the most minimal amount of, so it was the best fit kind of the match with his kind of width and diameter of his tibia.
So do they actually add the day of surgery, bring both bones?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. That was my understanding. And this is one that he thought he was going to use. So they removed, I think it was, so he had had 8 rounds of chemo. And then I think it was 10 afterwards. So around the end of, I think it was maybe, yeah, our anniversary is the 30th of May. I think it was May 31st, his surgery. And they, yeah, essentially like took out his tibia and replaced it with donor tibia and a lot of hardware to structurally keep that in place. And his incision is really long, goes from kind of the top of his knee all the way down to his ankle. The incision was larger than I thought it would be, but it makes sense. So Mac was a really hypermobile, flexible kid. And so he kind of got some double jointedness, but he was really a hyperextensive kid. So the concern was post-surgery that he would, because when you like had his leg out straight, like his knee would kind of come up. So the surgeon was really concerned that he would, we wanted to keep his leg mobilized and that he might, so we had him in kind of this knee brace because we wanted to keep it from extending. So that was kind of the biggest surprise that he goes from this really hyperflexible kid to months down the road when he should have been starting to kind of walk again. This is kind of towards the end of treatment. So then we did 10 weeks of chemo after that. We kind of have had some ongoing complications that bring us even to today's date with, not necessarily with surgery, but just, I mean, things that happen along the way. So his surgery was pretty, I mean, it was a pretty intense, big surgery. They felt they got good margins, all that good news. They didn't see any other evidence of cancer. He was pretty sure that he got it all. Again, we were really lucky because it was just localized. He hadn't metastasized. But he ended up developing a significant foot drop and his hamstrings and, I mean, everything just really constricted, super tight that he couldn't, even with lots of PT, he couldn't get his heel down. So we had this really awesome brace built for him that had a pretty good heel built into it so he could feel what it would be like to put his foot down. He wasn't given permission to be fully weight bearing. So he was in a walker for a really long time because it's just way more stable. I would choose a walker any day over, over crutches. And so, you know, he was in that until, you know, the end of treatment. And then after, when we kind of thought timeline, like when he was done with treatment, we thought maybe then he'd be able to start walking again. And he just couldn't. He couldn't get his foot down. He had a significant then limp. And we were really worried that that he wasn't going to be able to walk unassisted. He eventually switched to a forearm crutch, which was really helpful. So ditch the walker because he does not love the walker, especially as a teenager, right? Who, right? He's 13 at this point. Who wants to be in a walker? Nobody. So we then had kind of been given the option of if with PT and stretching and whatnot, we can't get that leg straight, then we would have to go back in there and have another surgery to elongate the Achilles and do a hamstring release. So that didn't happen, you guys. So he finished treatment October of 2018. And that surgery didn't happen until August of 2019. So he didn't walk unaided until, well, after that. So we even went on his Make-A-Wish trip last summer, and he was in a wheelchair the whole time because he couldn't walk for long distances. And we had the surgery, I think it was August of 2019. And it was really kind of a relief because I remember the surgeon coming out and he was like, because part of it, we didn't know if once he relaxed under anesthesia, like, was his leg going to be able to go straight? Because it was like, how much is this mental? How much of this is just him? You know, now his body's so used to it. But I remember his orthopedic oncologist coming out and he's like, I could not even get it straight under anesthesia when he was completely relaxed. So he did an Achilles release. So he's got a really big scar on the back of his heel. And then they snipped his hamstrings and his leg finally went straight. And so after that, he was kind of non-weight bearing in a boot. I would say he was walking without his crutch by maybe end of December, January of this year, 2020.
So almost 6 months, 5-6 months
after. Yeah. So he's probably, yeah. So maybe August to December. And right, so it's crazy. So essentially, like, he started walking unaided in January of this year, and he had a significant gait that he needed to work on because he's got a limp and he's been so adjusted to that. But it's kind of the things that you don't think about, and they talk about late term effects and everything, and, you know, your risk for secondary cancer. But not in a million years would I have thought a year plus after treatment that he still wouldn't have been walking on his own. Because some people just fly out of it. Like, some people are like, boom, I'm done. I'm going to kill it in PT. And they're, you know, they had total joint replacements and, you know, they're up and moving. And so it was just one of these things that we never even thought about. Anyhow, that was the beginning of this year. And then he started developing leg pain again, let's say March, April, right when COVID hit. So, like, our regular follow-up, we always get x-rays of his leg like every 8 to 10 weeks, and those had kind of been pushed off, and then his primary oncology appointment had been pushed off, and all of a sudden he's having like the same pain that he, like, right below his knee, that was similar to the pain he had like 2 years previous. So it was the longest tie, it was the longest like month and a half waiting for that appointment, because I was like, great, he's relapsed. Like, even though his x-rays before that showed nothing, right? But it was all I could go to because I was like, this is similar pain. Like, this is presenting the exact same way.
Unfortunately, like, that's kind of, I think, what happens. Like, we become so aware of our children and their what their, like, new normal is, like, after, you know, having that diagnosis. And then, like, when things look similar again, or you kind of have flashbacks of, like, oh, I think I remember she complained of that, or he complained of that, you know, or whatever. It's just, it instantly takes you back to that.
Instantly. There's just, I you know, somebody asked, like, how long does it take until you stop worrying? And I was like, I don't think, I mean, never. I mean, knowing myself, never. And it's so interesting because I think about Mac's age, and they recently changed, they used to say 5-year cure. And then, unfortunately, I think they've pushed that out to longer than that to say that there's a cure. But I've thought about it. I'm like, oh my gosh, he will be just going out of high school. And, like, presumably, I mean, I don't know, maybe he'll live at home with me forever, which would be lovely. Not really. But I was like, holy crap, you're telling me, like, he has to be in charge of his, like, if he's living independently, like, he has to pay attention to his symptoms. And I'm not going to be there, like, being acutely, like, aware whenever he doesn't feel well or whatnot. I was like, oh my gosh, like, I don't even, that poor child, like, I'll have him do like daily checks, like, how does your are you fatigued, are you, I mean, it's like, but the fact that, like, I won't have eyes on him all the time.
Yeah, that you kind of just pass that torch over to him, but then it's like, will he even notice any of the things that he's supposed to notice?
Yeah, exactly. Like, that is terrifying, because I don't think that you ever stop worrying.
I think that's what we do as parents and moms, or people who are taking care of who they love. I mean, it doesn't matter who you are. I just think that that's just, I think that's just part of human nature. And, like, if we didn't, there might be something else.
Yeah, I don't know. It's crazy. So to wrap up Mac's multiple surgeries, so we finally got in and had x-rays done. And actually, we had x-rays done. We weren't scheduled to see. I had actually contacted our orthopedic oncologist prior to his regular oncology follow-up. And I was like, his leg is hurting. Can we get another x-ray? So he said, sure. So we have that done. Then we go to our primary appointment. And I said, you know, we just got x-ray done, blah, blah, blah. And so he's like, well, let me see if it's ready. So he pulls it up. He's like, oh, yeah. He's like, there's a broken screw. But I was like, but is there cancer? He's like, nope, no evidence of disease. I'm like, oh, okay, phew. But I'm like, how in the heck did, I mean, you've seen these medical screws. Like, they are strong, and Mac is not a super active kid. Plus, he's barely been walking for very long. And so I jokingly said, I was like, did he get that from rolling from one end of the couch to the other? Like, how in the heck did he break a screw? So then we have a follow-up with his orthopedic oncologist. And what we think happened is that on that medial side where he's got a long plate, that we talked about this before, the top of the allograft and the bottom, so that cadaver bone, the bottom towards his ankle has been engrafting well with his own bone. But the top we've been watching now for a couple years because it just doesn't seem like it had been kind of closing that gap, like on image where you could see it's just not engrafting super well. So, and this has been kind of maybe an ongoing concern, but he kept saying if he's asymptomatic, then it's probably fine. Well, there probably was just enough microscopic movement in there over time because that of that little bit of a gap that we think that the then plate moved a little bit, which then broke one of the screws. But yay, mystery solved. The pain came from the screws, so hallelujah. But then it was like, oh my gosh, here we go again. So we're in the middle of COVID, but as soon as orthopedic oncologist saw that this was the case, he immediately like started trying to get a surgery time scheduled because he knew what that looked like. So about 8 weeks ago, he went in for another major surgery. They had to open up his entire incision again. They actually made it a little bit longer. They took out all of the, they took out the medial plate, so that kind of inside of the leg plate, took out all of the hardware. They took out half of the screw, but they left the other half in it because there was no way they were going to go in and invasively take it out. So he has like half a screw still in him. They put even more hardware in, and I'll post pictures because it's pretty impressive, like once you see the images. But then the worst part is they did a bone graft from his pelvis. So they had to go in, and that was the most painful part for sure. In fact, that was so painful that he hardly had any leg pain, which I was really surprised because they did a lot of work on his leg. But distracting injuries are like that. It's so fascinating. So they took the bone graft, then, you know, mixed it with whatever bone cement stuff and patched the top and the bottom so that there was no chance of things moving, put in even more hardware, a little bit longer. And he's was in his walker for four weeks or a little bit more. He's been 2 weeks using his forearm crutch, and we think in another 4 weeks he'll be walking. So I know, yay, exactly. So I know, I never would have imagined that. I mean, we'll be like almost 2 years post treatment, and he will have only like been walking unaided for like 5 months out of the whole time.
It's just so crazy just sitting here listening to this story about Mac and all of the things that he has went through and just like getting to that final piece of like, hey, we're only 4 weeks away to like potentially like walking. Like just the things that we take for granted every day that like, oh, I'm just going to get out of my bed and walk to the bathroom. Like it's just for a lot of these kiddos, that is just not the case. And they do have to go through really challenging obstacles to get to just what normal people see and do every single day.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It is crazy. Yeah. I know when you were I know this is I already kind of shared a little bit about Lucy's story, but when you kept saying walker, It totally took me back to this flashback of when Lucy got diagnosed with MRSA. Yeah. That one of the things that we thought something was wrong was that she couldn't walk. And I'll have to post this picture of her, but she had a walker for like 2 weeks.
Oh my gosh, a little tiny.
It was a baby walker. She was only three.
Did you laugh about it because your last name is Walker?
Actually, I laughed. It's hilarious. When people see it, you're like, is that even like a real thing?
But they actually have baby walkers for like 3-year-olds.
Yeah.
And so it just kind of took me back because until they figured out exactly that it was MRSA and trying to figure out why she couldn't walk either for just, you know, a couple of days. But it took a while. It probably took over maybe getting on to closer to 5 months of really gaining that strength back for being bedridden for almost a month. And, you know, even though she had PT, but she was down a lot and like just because her legs were just so tired and weak. And but I just it kind of took me back to that little baby walker that she did have. And then it kind of took me back even farther. I almost even forgot that Lucy had her little surgery when she had MRSA. They had
a drain put into her quadriceps. So what they had found out that the MRSA was actually between the two quadriceps. And so they had to put a drain to be able to drain the sac of bacteria that was growing in there. And so along the way, we had been waiting for several hours and, you know, we kind of checked back in every, you know, half hour to an hour just to make sure things were going okay because they had told us that Lucy would be 2 hours. At this point, it was over 2 hours and everyone just said, oh, well, she's back in recovery. Well, we had specifically told them that we wanted to be there when she woke up because that was something that we had found out that when Lucy did wake up, it was better that we were there. So we just kept asking and it happened to be, I think, on a weekend again. Everything for us just fell on the weekend and obviously the hospital is not staffed with their normal staff that they usually have. And so we just kept knocking on this door. And every once in a while, a nurse would come by. A few times they didn't, and we would just keep knocking. Finally, we got a hold of somebody, and they called back up to 10 South, where Lucy's room was, and they had said that she was in her room getting a blood transfusion. And we were like, excuse me? She went in for a drain in her quad for the MRSA infection, not a blood transfusion. Well, they quickly found out that they were wrong and that they were talking about another patient. And at that point, obviously, Kellen and I were so upset that we might have got a little irritated again just because there had been a few other things that had happened. And we just really felt that, you know, it's important for us to advocate for Lucy and use this as a learning opportunity for the medical staff itself because we know that there are other families that probably have gone through something like this. And it is just so important as parents to step up. And I think that just naturally we do that because our kids are our life. And when you trust somebody else with your child's life that you just met, you know, it's difficult. And we just knew that what was going on wasn't okay. So finally, we had met face to face with the surgeon. They had come out and told us that they had inserted the drain into the quadricep muscle. They were able to pull out 10 cc's of bacterial fluid and that hopefully this drain would continue to drain the rest of the MRSA infection that was in her leg. So that was kind of our surgery debacle that, you know, Lucy did have to face, but, you know, it was challenging for her. It was weird because she couldn't move very much just because she had a drain in her leg, but we were able to get through that really challenging time and kind of move forward in that we were just so grateful that they were able to put in this drain and remove the bacteria from her body.
There's no comparison. There really isn't. But I was just like, oh, I totally forgot all these things. And like all these,
I know when you talk about it and it comes back.
I know all these memories were like flooding in of like, oh yeah, she had a walker, but she had the baby walker. And then, you know, getting that drain put in for the MRSA to be able to get that infection out of her quadriceps. So yeah, it was just all of those things that I just like keep thinking about and thinking, wow, we really did go through so much.
How did she do with PT?
She actually did really well with it because they made it really fun. One of her favorite things was they had this container and you filled the balls into the container and then it like shot out. So the balls would like shoot out and then she'd have to take her baby walker and like go get the balls. And so it was always, they always made it fun, which I think was really great. The other thing that they absolutely loved was this like rocket. So she would have to, again, get to the rocket, which is obviously the end, like, reward. But she would, they would jump and step on the rocket and then, like, shoots up into the air. And I just remember, I think on that day, we were fortunate enough to, the Chelsea Hicks Foundation came through with all of the costumes. And obviously, we couldn't leave our room, but they, their volunteers are just so wonderful. And I remember Kristen bringing, you know, the dresses back to the girls and them getting all dressed up, and then we had PT, and so we were able to do PT in costume, which I think was even more fun that day. So I don't know. I just think that the people who work, you know, at the hospital and the different things that these children do need, they just absolutely love each and every one of them. And just really, I mean, they know their names, they know what they like, they know what they don't like, they even know what they don't like, but you're going to be doing this today because we have to get you to that next spot, you know? And I just think of all of those people up there as just angels, like just beautiful people that God created to just love on families and kids that are really going through a really sometimes shitty time.
Absolutely. We have had some amazing physical therapists up there, but Nicole has been like there from the beginning with us. I don't know if you remember Nicole. She's still there today. And when we were there for Max surgery, we spent the night, like she totally was like, I see Max on my schedule. And she comes up and of course he's like, ugh. Because Mac was not the greatest physical therapy participant ever, and he would complain and he wouldn't want to do his exercises, and bless her heart and all of the other OTs and PTs that worked with him, but she had him the most. She always had a smile on her face and she just knew him and was like able to match his humor and talk about things that she knew. I mean, this is like a year later. I mean, it's 2 years later. I mean, it's crazy, but she just swooped in there like, you know, 8 weeks ago, and I was like, all right, Mac, this is what we're doing. And I was like, holy cow, like, that's amazing that she was there, because we started doing PT prior to his surgery to try to build up strength. So like before his first surgery till 6-8 weeks ago. It's so crazy. And she just came in, she's like, all right, this is what we're doing.
I just love how they remember. I even, like, when I go back up to the hospital with Lucy, just seeing all the familiar faces, and everyone just absolutely loves their job and loves those kiddos. And I don't know, I'm sure it's the same everywhere, but there's always just that special little place up on the hill, you know, that you kind of get. And I loved before all of this stuff, but you would just get to have conversation and spend some time with them. Sometimes they'd come up off the floor and just, you know, just see how everyone's doing. They just love seeing how far kids have come and just being able to know where they were. And even as parents, or, you know, watching your loved one go through that, just seeing how far they come from literally, you know, getting the diagnosis and then, you know, not being, for Max, like not being able to walk. And then like in just a couple weeks, you're like, he's going to hopefully walk again. I don't know. It's just something about that that is just amazing. And those kids are amazing. And Mac is amazing. And Lucy's amazing.
Yeah, I think it's so cool. And I think it's really cool that I know a lot of hospitals, and I hope more, are doing kind of late-term effects follow-up. So, like, you get followed for the rest of your life. And I think that's really cool that they do, you know, like, certainly at that 5-year, that they'll do, you know, you go in for a big day and you do, you know, lab work and checkups, and you get followed kind of forever, which is really cool. We can talk more about that some other time, but I think it's so cool. I always remember when I was working in peds oncology, when people would come back after treatment and I would be like so grateful that they were there with their parents, because all of a sudden they're coming back with hair and they've probably grown. I'm like, you are completely unrecognizable. Like, if you were bald again, maybe I could recognize you. But I'm always like, oh, thank goodness the parents are there, because I recognize the parents. And then, yeah, it's just so funny. The first time, I mean, I think it's like this, the first time that you come back with hair to an appointment and people are like, oh my gosh, you have hair and you look so different, because we're so used to seeing them like so cute and bald.
I know. I actually really liked that little bald stage, I thought.
Oh my gosh, I loved it so much.
Yeah, Lucy just, I think it's so funny to think in her short 5 years of how many different looks, like she's like this movie star of like transitioning of all these different roles, but she seriously has
had like 10 different looks in just this short amount of time. And now like her hair is so long and curly and, you know, a lot lighter than it originally was. It was a really dark brown, like maybe even black when she was born. And then when it first started to come back, it was like this eerie blonde, like super light color. But now her hair is, you know, darkened up a bit, but she has like the same color hair as her sister Grace now.
Mac was super blonde. Like he was like, when he was little, I mean, he was towhead, like white blonde. And it started darkening, but it was still like you would still consider him blonde. And then when his hair started growing back, it actually was wavy for like maybe a couple months, which was totally crazy. And then that grew out and it's back straight again, but it's so much darker than it was. Like, I mean, I guess you would look at him and still think maybe he's blonde, but really it's like really dark, dark, dark blonde, which is so different than when he went in for treatment. It's crazy.
I know. Just all of the things in just a few short years of watching, you know, our kids go through that and just the changes and where they are now and what they're doing. It's really cool.
Yeah, it's super cool. So, okay, we talked about central lines. We talked about surgeries, which kind of go, right, central lines are surgeries. So we've talked about kind of that central line from day one or day whenever you can get it all the way through max multiple surgeries. You know, I know with a lot of people, especially like with osteosarcomas and if they're in the femur, kind of in that knee joint, you know, a lot of times people need total, you know, knee replacements or have to have multiple surgeries when you start getting taller. Like you have to have that 4'5" and then all of a sudden you're 5 foot and those need to be elongated. And so it's just so interesting how, depending on diagnosis, like what your life looks like for those long kind of term effects. And
but I also think that we've shared, you know, through this episode is that, you know, we should post those pictures. So make sure, you know, check out our website, www.bridgesofgold.com/podcast. And we do want to share those pictures of Mac and share some pictures of Lucy. But hey, it was always would be interesting if you want to email us or write in to share, you know, maybe what your experiences were. And I know Laura and I would love to share and talk about them because, you know, these are just two different perspectives and two different journeys. But we know that they're are so many out there that, you know, we may have some things that are similar, but again, we're all just a little bit different. And so sometimes hearing from other people on those experiences do help others on this journey because unfortunately, as we know, every day there's going to be a new child on this journey and a new family kind of embarking on this new journey. And I think having a little bit of insight of what it might look like might make things a little bit easier.
Guess what? Leia's been asleep this whole time. We'll have to post a picture of Leia. I didn't say her name. She's not even. She's in her dog bed. Oh, there she's awake now. She's like, what's going on? So from us, Ty and Laura and Leia, we say until next time.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us. We're always glad that you guys are listening.
Thanks, guys. Talk soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening, and we look forward to you joining us next time on the Golden Voices podcast. Make sure to check out our website, bridgesofgold.com/podcast, for show notes and other show-related information.